From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And President Trump has now signed a $484 billion coronavirus bill. That includes additional funding for the Small Business Loan Program, hospitals, and a nationwide testing program.
Meanwhile, the state of Georgia began its partial reopening today. South Carolina, Nebraska, Tennessee, and Oklahoma are also among the states beginning to lift restrictions. Alabama's stay-at-home order is set to expire next week, and Alabama's Republican Governor Kay Ivey is on the line. Governor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
So your stay-at-home order expires next week at the end of the month. Are you planning to reopen Alabama at that point?
Well, we're working hard to hopefully make that happen. The stay-at-home order does expire on April 30. We've got several different groups providing us very thoughtful recommendations on what reopening might look like and how it would occur. And most likely it's going to be a recommendation that is phased in carefully and slowly. But I've got the Small Business Committee that's given us a whole 150-some-odd pages of recommendations. And each of our congressional leaders have given us recommendations based off of their contacts with their members in their respective districts. And then I've got an executive committee of a coronavirus task force that is vetting all of these recommendations. And then on Monday, I'll be meeting with Dr. Harris, our public health officer, to review these recommendations and be sure that all of them also fit with the medical and health care protocol. So we're making progress to get the best information we can, using data as much as we can, but the whole goal continues to be to reopen in some fashion, hopefully next week.
Well, as you know, some of your neighbors are already reopening, Georgia, Tennessee, reopening some or most businesses. Why not follow the same path as them?
Well, I believe that data should drive our decisions, not just a desired date. And so we are looking at the numbers and the cases and the hospitalizations and ventilators, et cetera, and making our decisions based on data.
Are you facing a lot of pressure from people in Alabama, as we're seeing in some other states? Even your own lieutenant governor has said that he thinks it's time to reopen.
Well, a lot of people have a lot of opinions, and if you can imagine, I get a lot of free advice. And all of it is welcome, and all of it is being vetted and given careful consideration. But we've got to be sure we know what we're doing and not open so fast that we bring this relapse of this virus back. That's something we just for sure do not want to do.
Do you think that a combination of contact tracing and testing is going to be necessary in Alabama to safely reopen?
Well, it's certainly a factor of the whole process, and like I say, I'll be taking recommendations from our health care providers as well as from members of the Small Business Committee.
Well, why are testing levels so low in Alabama? You've tested about 1% of the population there. In Louisiana, they've already tested about 3% of the population.
Well, testing in Alabama has been done mostly by the Departments of Public Health, while we do have some private labs kicking into that. But you're right on the numbers. We've tested just a little less than 1% of our population, and we're struggling to ramp that up as best we can, but we need the supplies to do the testing as well.
Do you need that from the federal government, or where would you get those supplies?
Department of Public Health is accessing all of their contacts, and we're backing them up every way we can. If it's from the federal, that's fine. If it's from the normal suppliers, that's fine. We just want to get the supplies from wherever we can get them as soon as we can get them.
What would you say to residents of your state who believe that COVID-19 is overblown or the equivalent of a very bad flu season, something that Rush Limbaugh and others have been saying on media?
Well, everybody's entitled to their opinion, but at the same time, this COVID-19 is a serious virus. It's proven to be quite deadly, quite contagious. It is not to be taken lightly. It's not anything we've ever faced before. There's no vaccine, no cure at the moment. So this is a deadly, serious situation, and we've got to take appropriate action to protect the health and safety of our people.
Obviously, you're working your way through a crisis, as everybody is, but are you starting to think about the long term, about whether this will come back in the fall and the winter, as many experts predict that it will, and what that means for you?
Well, certainly we're looking forward to the possibility that it could come back, and that's another good reason that we're keeping the stay-at-home order in place through April 30. Haste makes waste, you know, and it'd be much more difficult to have to fight a reoccurrence than it would to stay the course. So we're trying to be measured and thoughtful and receptive to good ideas and recommendations, but also we're relying on the data.
Governor, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says states should be able to declare bankruptcy instead of getting bailouts. What do you think of that, and do you think declaring bankruptcy would be the right solution for Alabama if it gets there?
That's a subject I hadn't had time to think about, so I'd have to get with my finance folks to figure that out, but I certainly hope the state does not have to file for bankruptcy.
Well, do you think that it makes sense to get a federal bailout if it got to that point?
Playing what-if games at this stage is not very helpful right now.
What is your message, finally, to the people of Alabama as they go through this very difficult period, along with the rest of us?
Well, I sincerely want to thank all Alabamians for their resiliency during this pandemic and thank them for taking the stay-at-home order to heart and abiding by our safe distancing and all of our guidelines, because it's the people that makes this thing happen, and we can slow down the spread and minimize the decline by practicing these guidelines. And I just thank the people of Alabama for their participation. It all depends on our people, and I'm grateful that they are abiding by the stay-at-home order.
That is Alabama Governor Kay Ivey. Governor, thank you for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Let's get a view now from Wuhan, China, which is emerging from 76 days of stringent restrictions. It was the first city in the world to go on lockdown after the coronavirus pandemic started there late last year. The CNN's David Culver visited Wuhan before the lockdown and now after, and I caught up with him earlier via Skype as he was leaving Wuhan on a train and asked him to paint a picture for us of what it's like there now.
You know, it's a bit surreal to go back 3 months after our original trip down there. And what stands out to me now, having left after a couple of days back on the ground, is that this is a city that is clearly in a place of trying to resume, trying to get back online, certainly from a business perspective and just normal life resumption. But at the same time, there's a lot of hesitation. These are people who have gone through a 76-day brutal lockdown, who were sealed inside their homes in many cases. And they are really trying to find their comfort again and walking back out of their houses and enjoying life once more. But they do so with a cautious optimism.
Yeah, that hesitation. Are you feeling it at restaurants and stores? Are people going to those places? And what do those places look like now? Are there differences in the way that they're operating?
I could find no restaurant that was operating in a normal capacity as it once did. And what we saw, for example, in our hotel restaurant, were that tables for two were set up just for one. Tables for four were set up for two, with each chair on the alternate side of the other, so nobody was in close contact. Storefronts have moved their operations to the very front of the store so that people don't actually come inside. The same is true for most big brands, you know, Burger King, Starbucks, McDonald's. And then actual stores are also doing the same. I mean, there's a lot of window shopping, but it stops at the window.
So with that, I know that this is really the time of year where it's warming up in China. Even though folks are hesitant to go into those places, are they spending more time outdoors?
Oh, for sure. And we noticed that even at a park that we were at just yesterday, people were starting to get together. Overall, you do see a real desire for people just to want to be outside. You don't blame them, especially if they were quite literally sealed inside their homes for that duration of time to get some fresh air. They realize it to be a luxury now. And quite frankly, they're not sure if it'll last. I think a lot of people believe there might be a second wave, Tanya.
You know, that really speaks to this larger debate here about when parts of the country can reopen. Do you see how they've handled this over the last few weeks as a model on how we should possibly reopen, really?
It's very difficult for me to endorse one way over the other, because things here are definitely handled a very distinct way from for example, in the U.S. and even parts of Europe. I did find it interesting as I was hearing, for example, the state of Georgia considering to open the hair salons and cinemas and bowling alleys and tattoo parlors. And so I wanted to go to some of those places in Wuhan to see how they started to come back online. And you noticed that some, like hair salons, were actually reopening, but they were changing their procedures. So the one hairstylist that I had learned how they were doing things was simply buffering each client by an hour. And in that hour in between, no client comes in and out, so there's no overlap of their customers, and they do a complete sanitation in between. Other places, like a cinema, a movie theater, or even a fitness center, completely closed and no intention to open in the near future.
So much to work out, so much to learn as we move through this time. That's CNN's David Culver. Thank you so much for joining us in this update.
Thanks, Tanya. Be safe.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
We've seen those devastating images of coronavirus victims in body bags. In some cities, officials have had to store them in freezers because the number of deaths are outpacing the ability to handle them. In Georgia, where many businesses are reopening today, Daugherty County has seen the highest death rate in the state, and it's overwhelming the coroner's office there. And for more, we have with us Michael Fowler. He's the Daugherty County coroner, and he's been working around the clock to process the bodies of COVID-19 victims in the county. And he joins us via Skype. And Michael, describe to me what your day is like and how you're able to handle this.
Well, normally we process, like I said, go to one family house and deal with one family a day sometime. But now we're dealing with five families, five different emotion feelings from each family. Early in the morning, most of the time I get phone calls, even during the night, family lost someone. Sometimes it's at the resident, sometimes it's at the nursing home, sometimes it's at the emergency room. And dealing with family members, helping them to get through the process is difficult. Sometimes, because they don't understand how this virus got into my home, how it got into my loved one, why me? And so a lot of them is in shock and disbelief. But then once we start testing to find out the person did have the virus, a lot of family members are concerned. Do I have it? What I need to do? Where I usually go into a house with a suit and tie on, sit down with the family, shake hands, pray with them, comfort them. Now I have to go in with Tyvek suit, mask, gloves, and as a snowman, in a sense, going in, and stay my 6 feet away. So it's a different environment now that we're living in.
Yeah. You've worked in 23 major disasters, including Hurricane Maria and the tsunami in Thailand. How does this compare?
This is a different virus, even at World Trade Center. I mean, you got a tornado coming, a hurricane, flood. You can get up on higher ground. You cannot see the virus. Person carrying it, they can come in contact with you, you can contract this virus. So it's a hidden disaster that you don't know about, but you see in the results, the number of people that have died. I mean, it's a different disaster that I had never dealt with before.
Mm-hmm. Some of this is personal. You know people who have passed away. I'm wondering, how are you dealing with this while also the call of duty as a coroner?
I believe God just gave me the strength. It's difficult dealing with a situation like this because I know so many individuals in our community versus going to New York. You didn't, at the World Trade Center, you didn't know those individuals. When you go to Puerto Rico, go to Haiti, I didn't know the individuals. So it was a job that I had to do. But now it's more personal because it's friends that you know, coworkers that you know, family that you know that's dying or on the ventilator. It's more touching and more tiresome, I say. And it takes a lot out of you. somewhere in this community, we're probably going to have a psychological, mentally, emotional impact once all this is over, because people have never dealt with something like this before.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I guess what you're saying is right now you are in that mode of just trying to survive. No one has taken the step, including you, to really process the impact of what's happening right now.
That's true. That is so true. We'll never go back to the norm, I don't think. I think we'll always think now about this virus. It can come back on you. So we're just going to be always, I think, be more prepared now.
Yeah. How prepared are you to handle the number of bodies you're dealing with right now if this rate of death continues? Do you have enough people and equipment?
Right now we do. At first we didn't have enough, body bags, enough Tyvek, N95, but eventually the government finally got the materials and supplies that we needed. But at first we were kind of like shorthanded, trying to use stuff over and over again. But now I think we pretty well supplied. Same thing with our morgue. The morgue was running over. Now the GEMA and the Department of Public Health, we have gotten a morgue, mobile morgue now that we can take care of the overflow. So we are more equipped now than we was 3 weeks ago.
You work in conjunction with funeral homes. How has this relationship changed now?
Well, the funeral homes, I'm a mortician too. But funeral homes, many of the funeral homes are running over. They are processing, embalming bodies, and a lot of them are cremating. They had said the same thing. We don't have room to keep bodies. So now they're kind of processing funerals quicker and cremation a little bit quicker now than they normally do because they have so many bodies stacking up. And many times they want to, you know, leave them in the morgue temporarily until they get to the, get room for somebody else to move out so they can bring someone else in. But it's just different in our whole community with this many deaths. And we're doing grave sites, and you're limited to the number of people that come to the graveside. So emotionally, you're not having complete closure. The families can't go back there to see them. So you're not even able to say goodbye to them. So that the virus came down on them. They rushed to the emergency room and they just died. I mean, I think it's going to have a great impact.
How are you keeping yourself both mentally and physically strong during all of this?
Well, be honest, I think it's a ministry for me, ministry. I feel God have prepared me for this season from all the disasters that I worked in the past. I'm praying and just moving forward, and I feel that I need to be there for the families to help them through this process of grieving and dealing with the loss of their loved one. But I'm doing great.
Yeah. You see this COVID-19 crisis through the lens of death. What's your call to action for the living?
I think we need to keep practicing social distancing. Pay attention to our own health. We start having signs of running fever or coughing or difficult breathing. We need to get to the emergency room somewhere as quick as possible. And then if someone cough in your sleeve or cough in your coat, but don't cough in your hand, then go shake someone else's hand. South Georgia is used to doing that. We're so socially distant that we love shaking hands, we love hugging and putting our arms around one another, bumping one another. But now it's different. We can't do that now.
That's Michael Fowler, coroner in Daugherty County, Georgia. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
While President Trump signed another coronavirus relief bill today, his administration is still in the midst of distributing funds from last month's CARES Act, which includes hundreds of billions of dollars for states and cities and $8 billion to help tribal nations. This weekend is the deadline to distribute that money to tribal governments. And in Indian country, there's controversy over who exactly should be eligible. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr explains.
Chairman Gerald Gray of the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council has been spending a lot of time on conference calls from his office in Montana.
You know, it's a lot of discussion about the funding that hasn't come out that's supposed to be coming down the pipe.
Gray's organization represents 11 tribes whose economies are hurting. Casinos are closed. Oil revenue that funds vital social services has taken a nosedive. Gray says CARES Act funding will make a difference for all 574 federally recognized tribes. But the fine print of the CARES Act says another group is eligible for a piece of that $8 billion pie, Alaska Native Corporations, or ANCs. They're businesses whose shareholders are Indigenous Alaskans, but they could end up with half of the money set aside for tribal governments.
The Alaska Native Corporation should not be getting any of the funding because they're not tribes.
Every major tribal organization in the lower 48 agrees. Over a dozen tribes are even suing the Trump administration over the controversy. It's stirred up anger, distrust, and above all, confusion in Indian country. Paul Ontaguk is not surprised.
Well, people are confused about everything concerning Alaska Natives.
He's a professor of Alaska Native Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He says all this is rooted in a history that most Americans aren't familiar with. In the 1960s, tribes were taking the feds to court over treaty provisions, things like their hunting and fishing rights, and they were winning. Congress wanted its relationship with natives in the brand new state of Alaska to be different.
And the alternative became creating state charter private corporations in which all the shareholders would be Alaska Natives.
Tribes in Alaska would turn their land over to these ANCs, which would provide for the tribes, and the federal government would be off the hook. This system is still in place today. Ontaguk says one big advantage is how ANCs have banded together to lobby Congress on behalf of Alaska Natives.
If you don't have a coherent voice, then you don't get a greater voice in how Congress distributes funding. The problem isn't what Alaska Native organizations are doing. The problem is what the tribal governments have not done.
But for Chairman Gray of the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council, the influence ANCs have is exactly the problem. And he says tribes shouldn't have to lobby the government for help that was already promised to them in treaties. Gray also points out that Alaska's 229 tribes could be eligible for funding in addition to the corporations that represent them.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, that's double dipping.
But ANC leaders are standing their ground. President Shauna Hegna of the Koniag Corporation says the best way to get aid to Alaska Natives is through ANCs.
Alaska Native corporations are eligible for funding under the CARES Act because we're included in the law. And we're going to use the funding to help our communities prepare and respond to COVID-19.
For many Alaska Natives, the big question is whether these for-profit corporations that are used to investing money will do a good job distributing it to local programs and services. For tribal nations, it's whether the aid they end up with will be enough to keep them afloat. Meanwhile, Professor Ontaguk points out that the $8 billion at the center of this fight is less than 0.5% of the total relief package, and many tribal leaders say that wasn't enough to begin with.
You don't fight for the furniture when somebody's burning down your house.
For Here and Now, I'm Savannah Marr.
The maker of Lysol has issued a statement today telling people that under no circumstances should they inject or otherwise ingest their cleaning products. That might sound like a no-brainer, but Lysol evidently felt it was necessary to remind people after President Trump appeared to suggest at a press conference yesterday that injecting bleach could help kill the coronavirus.
And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning?
Well, today he claims he was being sarcastic when he said that. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So we're seeing today that Twitter is calling Trump the Tide Pod president for that suggestion. How did we get here?
Oh, boy. Oh, where do you start? Well, there is some research from the Homeland Security Department that explores various chemical disinfectants, as well as various weather conditions, especially very sunny skies, and describes their various effectiveness on killing the coronavirus on surfaces. Now, that is really important, but the key word there is surfaces. So in other words, if you cough and sneeze and some of the droplets land on the sidewalk or a park bench, then heavy sunlight or these chemical disinfectants can kill off the virus in those droplets. And a official with the Homeland Security Department actually briefed reporters at the press conference yesterday on that research. Then Trump sort of wondered out loud, well, if that's the case, could there be a way to sort of repurpose this stuff, use the ultraviolet light or disinfectants to treat patients who already have the virus? But given how influential the president is, at least to some people, Reckitt Benckiser, which makes Lysol and a bunch of other cleaning products, felt they had to get out in front of this and just say, you know, by no means should you ingest these chemicals.
Mm-hmm. And we said, the president did say today that he was being sarcastic, but listen, here's more of what he said yesterday.
Again, I say, maybe you can, maybe you can't. I'm not a doctor, but I'm like a person that has a good, you know what.
Okay. So, Mike, I can't believe we're talking about this. The thing is that calls to poison control centers are already up actually about 20% this year, not because people are ingesting this stuff probably, but because they're cleaning with it and maybe it's coming more into contact with their skin. We do know that people take what the president says very seriously. We've been talking about hydrochloroquine. He's been hyping that up. And there was a man in Arizona who died after taking that to try to prevent the coronavirus after hearing President Trump tout it on TV. People do take what he says seriously.
Right. And there's sort of a backstory, too, that last year the FDA actually had to issue a warning about something called Miracle Mineral Solution, which has been touted by some as a cure for everything from cancer and AIDS to viruses like this. And basically, when you use this as directed, mix it with a citric acid like lemon juice, it basically becomes a bleach. And there have been many in the sort of the QAnon pro-Trump conspiracy theory community that had been touting this as a cure for the virus, too. So it's not that far-fetched to think that people will start taking this stuff seriously. So clearly it's best to just raise the alarm and say, you know, this is very dangerous.
This is not true. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And one big change for many of us during this pandemic is the way we shop for food. Many of us are now shopping for groceries online, and if you physically go to the store, you may have to stand outside in a line and deal with empty shelves once you're inside. Well, our next guest says this pandemic may change the way we shop for good. Ian Bagost is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, and he's written about this, and he's also professor of media studies at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
So let's first start our conversation with online shopping. You report that Instacart's order volume is up 150%. They're hiring 300,000 new personal shoppers. But we're also hearing folks are still experiencing a lot of delays in delivery. What's happening right now with online grocery shopping?
Well, the demand is enormous now, greater than it's ever been. And if you take a step back and think about online grocery shopping, for a lot of people, it's totally new. Most folks have never tried to buy their groceries online. In fact, only about 3% of grocery shopping was conducted online before the pandemic crisis arose, which compares to maybe 30% for apparel, up to 50% for media like books and movies.
Wow.
So a lot of people are discovering this for the first time now. And one of the things they're discovering is that the way that you shop for groceries online is different from the way that you shop for shoes online, because you have to actually get the materials from a store that is not organized for like a warehouse like would be for online fulfillment.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember I was doing this about 10 years ago with Amazon Fresh, and there's some things that you don't think about. One thing is that I think we as human beings are just used to physically picking out our own food. We want to touch the apples.
True. Yeah, it's one of the reasons why it's taken so long for online shopping to catch on. And maybe that's not even the right way of saying it. You know, there's even in the future that we're now facing, I think people are still going to go to the grocery store most of the time. The experts that I've talked to have suggested that maybe if we reach 20% penetration for online grocery shopping in the next couple few years, that might represent more than we ever anticipated.
Well, that really brings the question, like, over the next few months, will we see this movement towards it in a way that will meet that threshold? Because now we're being forced to because of the circumstances that we're in.
So it's a complicated question. One of the things that's going on is that people don't want to go to the store. They feel unsafe going to the store. And so there may be more demand to hire that work out. Of course, that means that the grocery personnel who are in the store already and those personal shoppers, as Instacart calls them, those folks are also at risk. So there is a kind of issue of safety and also a kind of labor dispute arising around what it means to send those folks out to pick our groceries for us and what kind of conditions and pay they need and deserve. And that will continue to play out. But another aspect is that as more and more people lose their jobs to the economic fallout of the coronavirus crisis, more of them will think, well, I need something to do to make a living. Mm-hmm. And Instacart, as you mentioned, wants to hire hundreds of thousands of shoppers. Amazon, too, has hired something like 175,000 new personnel for various different roles. So those jobs may offer some kind of economic relief, and hopefully they'll be made safe and the kind of hazard pay associated with them will match the risk that these folks are taking on. But even if that gets resolved, the whole structure of the supermarket business, that is also a limitation. One of the factors, as we already discussed, is that the supermarket's laid out for you and me to go in, to see everything, to work around the edges and see the end caps where the promotional elements are displayed. It's an inefficient way to lay out a warehouse. So that is something that the industry will have to begin coming to terms with. And some of those efforts were already underway. One thing that we expected to see and are now starting to see maybe much more rapidly is the idea of like a kind of a dark store, it's sometimes called, or I've been calling them ghost groceries, a store that is only used for pickup and delivery orders. Kroger has closed down at least one store for that purpose.
But you say that more likely big companies like Kroger and Amazon will benefit from this type of model because they actually have the infrastructure and the power to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of a dream of returning to a sort of century-old way of getting food. And if you think about the grocery store itself, the supermarket, it is about 100 years old in concept, and it started with the Piggly Wiggly in Memphis in 1916. And that idea of like self-service grocery that we now take for granted as natural was not natural at one point. You'd go to separate shops, the butcher, the baker, the greengrocer, and you'd ask them for what you wanted, and we had more fresh material. And so there is a possible future in which we return to that a little bit more.
Okay, so small local stores would benefit in this way.
They would benefit provided that they have the leverage, the runway, the capital to do so. And the reason why that's going to be hard is that those stores are suffering right now, whereas the big players, they have the not just the capital, but also the physical plant and the sort of logistics and supply chain systems. So what I think is more likely is that we'll see an entrenchment of the biggest players.
So really, if this pandemic changes grocery stores as we know them, you're kind of giving these as options of what it might look like. Kind of put this together for us in the next few years, what we will see, and would grocery stores as we know them right now still exist?
Grocery stores are definitely going to continue existing. I don't think there's a decline or an abandonment of grocery stores. A lot more people are going to try their hand at online shopping, and maybe we'll see more different varieties of online shopping for groceries arise. Right now, we've kind of just got one model, and it doesn't work super effectively because very few people use it. It's mostly a luxury service. There'll be an evolution of those patterns. More people will discover, you know, local farm delivery or other kinds of specialty delivery. And then the biggest shops, these superstores, I think they'll convert more of their space away from consumer use for something like fulfillment of pickup and delivery orders. And then maybe we'll see more stuff find its way into the supermarket. But one of my theories is that the decline of the shopping mall, you know, may find some of those kinds of retailers to set up camp in a way inside, you know, the biggest warehouse stores. And we've already seen that happening over the past, you know, couple decades too.
Very interesting. That's Ian Bogost. He's professor of media studies at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His Atlantic article is The Supermarket After the Pandemic. We'll link it at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, professor.
Thank you.
Well, in some cities, many people rely on those corner stores for their food. As Farida Javala-Romero from member station KQED reports, those markets are also feeling the pinch.
Abdul Talib owns Mi Carnal Market in Oakland's Fruitvale District. He says most of his customers are low-income Latinos or elderly folks who live nearby. Many don't have a car.
They depend on us to go buy their milk, their eggs, their rice, because they don't have you know, their resource, or they just don't want to go to big stores.
But since panic shopping began, Talib and dozens of other small store owners say they can't bring in enough of the basics because distributors now ration how much they can buy. Talib says he used to get 80 cases of flour per week. Now it's only 3. Plus, prices are up. An 18-pack of eggs now costs him $4.99, double what it was a month ago.
It's very hard for us to, at this time when people are losing their jobs, you know, they have no income, for us to charge, you know, the price.
A regular at Talib's market, Angeles Rocha, says she's buying fewer groceries. She says her husband, a janitor, was recently furloughed with no pay, and she also lost her income from a childcare gig. The couple worries how they'll feed their 3 kids and pay the bills. One of Talib's wholesale distributors, Jetro Restaurant Depot, says they're not getting enough supply, and manufacturers are charging higher prices. Richard Kirshner is the company's president.
We're not making a nickel more than we used to make.
Small grocers have long gotten squeezed as big volume buyers like Walmart and Costco get better bargains. Now, the shortages could be amplifying that disadvantage for the little guys, says Richard Sexton. He teaches agricultural and resource economics at the University of California, Davis.
Food manufacturers and distributors are going to probably prioritize their biggest and best customers.
At Mi Carnal Market, Talib worries he can't find the basics for his store at prices customers can afford.
At the end of the day, if we don't have, you know, merchandise for the clients, then we don't have business.
Experts say the food supply chain should return to normal once people stop overbuying. Business owners like Talib hope that day comes soon. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Yabala Romero.
April is National Poetry Month, and this month PBS begins airing the second season of the series Poetry in America. Guests like John Kerry, Sheryl Sandberg, and Nas talk about great American poems. Katie Couric discusses the poem One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. Here's part of it.
The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster.
Well, Katie Couric joins us now. Katie, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Nice to be with you.
Well, and what does this poem mean to you?
Well, you know, when Lisa New approached me and wanted me to participate in a project celebrating poetry, I said I would love to because I think poetry is an important and wonderful art form. And there are many, many poems that I love. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I selected One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. I think it's because I've had so much personal loss in my own life and that this poem is so complex and so fascinating. It's really the poet herself trying to convince herself that something is true, which just isn't the truth. And that is that the art of losing isn't hard to master.
So there was a headline a couple of weeks ago that said, in regards to how we're all feeling right now about coronavirus and all the changes that are going on, that feeling that you have right now is grief. How would you describe what we're losing right now in this crisis?
I think this poem could not be more relevant than it is right now because there are so many different kinds of loss and there are so many different kinds of grief. And I think that we've lost a lot right now. Hopefully it's temporary, but I'm sure that this experience is going to leave scars for months, if not years to come, on a lot of people because they've lost people they've loved. They've lost huge milestones in their lives, the chance to celebrate them. I think of all the people who've lost an opportunity to celebrate their high school years or celebrate a college graduation. I think there's so many different degrees of loss that are going on. People are experiencing collective and individual grief.
Well, how do you make it what we're losing not be a disaster? Given your all of your experience with loss, what would you say to people out there who, you know, may want to master it rather than have it be a disaster?
Well, the whole premise of the poem, I think, is that she's convincing herself it's not. And of course, I think actually accepting disappointment, accepting loss is really important. You know, I lost my husband when I was 41 and we had a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. And I had to rebuild and recreate the life I had envisioned for us going forward. I think processing, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I imagine processing the loss, what it means and how you move forward is the most important thing, whether it's losing a job and trying to figure out what you're going to do, losing someone you love and trying to figure out how you're going to live without that person, or losing an experience and trying to figure out other experiences that will hopefully not replace it, but perhaps make up for it in different ways. But what the hell do I know, Jeremy?
Well, you're not a psychiatrist, but you are a journalist, and you were the host of the Today Show during 9/11 and its aftermath. You anchored the CBS Evening News during the financial crisis. Do you think that this moment is going to go down as a bigger deal for the world than 9/11?
I don't like to compare tragedies necessarily. I think every tragedy has a huge impact, but I think because this has had such a global impact and that the enemy is even more invisible than quote unquote terrorism, and that people are learning about the aforementioned enemy in real time, and it's changed the way we live. You know, the way we responded to 9/11 was to keep on going, to not sort of acquiesce to the fear that terrorists try to engender in a population. But in this case, the only way to respond is really to stop everything. So I think it's had such a chilling effect and a paralyzing effect on life as we knew it. And because the re-entry period is so uncertain, I think it will probably have a bigger impact because of the implications, which are still very much unknown.
Well, Katie Couric, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you, Jeremy.
And you can read the whole poem, One Art, at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.